What do you do if you are a white liberal living in South Africa? You're in revolt against the system of racial oppression, yet you are part of that system because as a white you are part of the privileged minority in power. This was the basic question that led Janet Levine to make some pretty tough choices in her life. Levine is a liberal white South African. She opposed apartheid through her work as a student activist, journalist, and member of the Johannesburg City Council. Her political mentor was Helen Sussman, the liberal member of parliament. Levine was also a founding member of the first black-owned business cooperative in South Africa. But in 1984, Levine came to the conclusion that the white liberal was no longer relevant in the battle between black nationalists and the white racist government. She moved with her family to Boston, where she now lives in self-exile. She's written a new memoir titled Inside Apartheid. I asked Janet Levine to elaborate on the paradox she faced as a white liberal in South Africa.
It's very apparent that because one is white in South Africa, one lives the type of lifestyle that is impossible at this stage for blacks to live. One has privilege, one has access, one has freedom of movement within the bounds of the limits the government imposes on everyone. One has a modicum of freedom of speech. For instance, I was allowed to get up on platforms and say things that a black activist would be not allowed to say, would simply have been removed and put into detention. So from that point of view, to blacks, white liberalism is not an understood phenomenon. And then being black, any black person is part of the oppressed, and therefore an activist just simply by being black, just by the daily sort of life that a black person has to lead, they are part of the repression, part of the oppression, and therefore part of the political dynamic. So I'm not black. I couldn't be part of that type of oppression. But being white, I had to make a choice to choose to be an activist liberal. And that is the paradox. And most whites don't understand that either.
Don't understand why you oppose the system?
Correct. And the party that I represented, the Progressive Federal Party, which had a long history of being a human rights liberal party, it was often a paradox to me to go into people's homes and canvass them for their votes, you know, being whites being the only people allowed to vote, and really be saying to them, vote for us and we're going to give away your prestige and your access and your privilege. So, you know, there is that paradox.
Were there actions that you would take in the course of a regular day that would make you feel like you were indeed complicit with the system?
Only in that, you know, every minute of the day I was aware that I was living in a white suburb, that I had access to transport that black people wouldn't have. That if, for instance, if I went into a store, that automatically the person behind the counter would be us, would turn to me before a black person to serve me. That sort of daily type of living. But I was very aware of, in the broader sense, of, you know, trying very hard not to be complicit with the system.
You say that as the government thought of you as a danger to the state, black activists thought of you as a white liberal and therefore irrelevant. Did you ever feel that white liberals were irrelevant to changing apartheid?
Yeah, that was the sad sort of resolution I came to shortly before I resigned in 1984 from public office. I felt that the sweep of history had moved very much towards a clash between black nationalists and white nationalists, and that in a way the liberals and the credo of liberalism was merely building the bridges that a type of revolution was needed to totally sweep away and just put into motion a change, a total change in the society. So I just felt that those white liberals like myself who held positions in government bodies were giving credibility to the lie that, in fact, there was some type of democratic practice in South Africa. And it was apparent to me that for a long time I was able to do quite a lot, especially using the media and getting the word out in the international press and to other South Africans, calling the government to account, putting on record trying to get them to answer why they had produced such and such a law. But once censorship became a real problem for the media, even that access disappeared. And it just seemed to me that being in a government body, I was helping to prop up apartheid. The ground had disappeared, that ground on which I, from which I could operate.
Was there a turning point for you where you reached that conclusion?
I think it had been a gradual process since 1976 with the first so-called riots of the children in Soweto. It became very apparent to me then with my dealings with the children and with adult Sowetans and my work on a black newspaper subsequent to that, that the mood amongst blacks themselves had changed. And I began to realize that, in fact, the dynamic in South Africa was going to be, the government had structured it in such a way it was inevitable, there was going to be a white nationalism, black nationalism clash, and that the whole political movement had swung towards black activism and revolution and away from a type of inculcation of human rights.
Were you thinking, I'm sorry, go ahead.
So I think that's the point. And then in 1984, when the government came up with a new constitution, that made it constitutionally impossible for blacks to be enfranchised. That, to me, was the ultimate turning point.
Did you start to feel that whichever one, the black nationalist or the white nationalist, that there'd be no room for you in South Africa?
Yes, I did feel that. There are a number of liberals who worked alongside me for many years who don't feel that. Some of them have swung to the right and have actually voted for the government because they also, in a sense, sensed what I did, that there has been this movement, this split in the society that's becoming more and more divisive. And there are many white activists who have moved into more type of revolutionary grassroots movements. I still think that in the long run, it is a black struggle. And the whites who go along with it are really fellow travelers as opposed, you know, they're not black. And I think that in the end becomes the vital point.
My guest is Janet Levine, and she's written a new memoir titled Inside Apartheid, One Woman's Struggle in South Africa. When you made your decision to enter politics, you knew in a way that that meant operating within a white-only world, since the world of politics was really closed to blacks.
I think, you know, I'm a self-confessed political junkie. And being that, I knew that I wanted to be involved in all the excitement that politics brings, the challenges and the opportunities. I also knew that I don't think that I'm of the material of which martyrdom is made. So the option for a white activist is either to go into a type of party political situation, which I did, or to move to the ranks of the revolutionary movements with the very strong possibility of having to go to prison or to be in detention or to be banned or exiled or any one of the other government the sort of created repressions. And, you know, I just did not choose to do that. I am not a martyr. I just didn't see the value of serving time at the government's behest.
Was it hard to get elected as a liberal?
Yes, it was always a struggle, and it was always dubious. One never quite knew what external events would change people's minds. The area that I represented had, for many, many years, voted for Helen Suzman on the parliamentary level. I represented the area that she represented that on the Johannesburg City Council. It was a continual battle. One had to keep going back to voters. One could never really rely on the majority of people in the area voting for one.
What kinds of people served on city council with you? Were they mostly upholders of apartheid and very conservative?
Yes. Johannesburg is the biggest urban area in South Africa, and the majority of my fellow councillors were Afrikaner nationalists. And yes, they ranged from conservative to ultra-conservative. And the ones I really were the most suspicious of and disliked the most were those who dressed up in their Gucci suits and had this urbane outer composure, but inside were really diehard reactionaries.
What do you think was the most dangerous and outrageous decision that city council made while you served?
I think the whole handling of the strike of 10,000 municipal workers in July 1980 could have led to, it didn't, but it could have led to just a major bloodshed in the streets of Johannesburg. So I think that the way that was handled was the most dangerous decision that they made.
What was the time that you felt most effective on city council?
During that same strike, I really felt that for the first time I was able to use the media and to use the press in the way that one of the great human rights precepts that I really still believe in so strongly, you know, the freedom of the press, I was able to use the media to really move events in a way that is just impossible without even a moderately free press.
How were you treated by your fellow city council members? Did they see you as a traitor because you wanted to undermine white power in the country?
Well, I was one of a group of 18 representing my party, the PFP, the Progressive Federal Party. And within our ranks, there was also a range from what I call Tammany Hall placaters to a few outrageous people like myself. So even within the ranks of my own party, I was often accused, in fact, of being a traitor, of wanting to sell the whites out. And certainly there was no coming together on any ground with my opposition, who were the proponents of apartheid.
I'm interested in what it was like to grow up in South Africa and to gradually become aware of what apartheid meant and to gradually start to oppose it. Did your parents support the system?
My parents were studiedly apolitical. They did not feel it safe for whites, particularly middle-class whites and Jewish white South Africans, to be involved in politics. They just felt that we should live our lives, keep our blinkers on, and get on with it. So, to answer your question, no, they were not political.
You had black servants when you were growing up,
as
I guess most of the whites in suburbs did and do. You tell a very interesting story about when you were 8 years old and you were staying at your aunt's house for a while, and one of her servants was pregnant, and she had taken off for her birth, and the servant's baby died in childbirth. And tell what happened after that.
Well, the way I remember it is that we were sitting on the veranda one afternoon having tea, and this particular maid walked past the bottom of the garden wall. We could just see her head. And my aunt exclaimed and stood up and went down to the driveway to talk with her. And she asked the maid how come she'd come home so soon, because she'd had leave for a month or 2 months. I can't remember exactly. And this had been just a couple of days after the maid had given birth. And the woman said that her baby had died, and that she needed the money because she wanted to come back to earn more money because there'd been these extra costs of the funeral, and that was why she was back so soon. And I was standing next to my aunt, and I just remember looking at this woman, and what particularly struck me were how scuffed her shoes were, and she sort of walked with a real defeat and a weight hanging on her shoulders, and yet her face was really quite composed and, in a way, very calm. And my aunt had pressed her about details about how the baby died, and she had just been very matter-of-fact that he'd stopped breathing and so on. And she proceeded round to the back of the house, and I went with my aunt to sit down to finish our tea. And she turned to me and she said, those blacks, they just don't feel the same way that we do. And I just remember being absolutely thunderstruck, because I just knew, just looking at that woman and her whole demeanor, that she was just devastated by the death of her baby. So I think it was just incidents like that, when I really searched my memory, that pinpoint for me a sort of realization of stereotyping and inadvertent almost racism.
You spent so much of your adult life in South Africa working against the apartheid system. I was wondering what it was like in your own family, if you would get into arguments with your aunt or with your parents about apartheid.
Right. I think I was a bit young with my aunt. I mean, just the realization that flooded over me at that point, I didn't understand myself and wasn't able to articulate. But certainly later, when I was very drawn to the whole liberal sort of dynamic and wanted to be part of that, yes, I had really strong arguments with my parents, who knew quite rightly that any number of students and activists were all the time just constantly being detained or having their passports taken away or being put under banning orders. And of course, they were very fearful that the same thing would happen to me. So that was the one aspect. They were very afraid for me. The other aspect is that we certainly didn't agree on the whole all the things that I believed in. They really did not feel like most other white South Africans. They just did not feel that blacks were in any way ready to be part of a government. And, you know, and I, for whatever reason, and that's something I really try to examine in the book, I just never saw it that way. I just saw blacks as other people and knew that given the equal opportunity, that everybody could work together.
What was your first encounter with black life in South Africa outside of talking to the servants in your family?
The first instance that I can remember is going into one of the townships around Johannesburg called Alexandra, or commonly known as Alex, which is a really deprived and depressed township. They all are, but this one is particularly grim. And in Alex, there was a creche or a daycare center where a friend of mine's mother, I was about 15, 16, and my friend's mother was working with a group of women activists who call themselves the Black Sash, and she was they used to support this creche, and she was the liaison person. And I went with her and my friend into the township, and not only was the first time I was meeting a black person on a basis other than a master-servant relationship, but it was the first time I'd actually seen a black township, and I remember just being devastated. We got to this creche, and there were all the little kids outside were snotty-nosed and running around in torn clothes, but inside they were all neatly dressed with little pinafores and just drinking huge mugs of milk. And I met the woman in charge, the supervisor, who was the first black person who I had seen in a position of authority, and you know, she certainly came across as an efficient person running the creche. I remember it did not seem strange to me at the time. So I don't think that I had really thought that black people should only be servants. You know, it just wasn't a strange phenomenon to me.
Let me ask you, I'm curious, when you were in city council and when you were working against apartheid, were there servants in your family?
Yes, we always had domestic servants, both in my parents' household and in my own.
How did you, since you opposed apartheid, how did you handle having servants? And were you able to establish a different kind of relationship with them?
Yes, I hope the latter is correct. It's certainly one of those complex issues in South Africa. The unemployment need amongst black people is so enormous that the bush telegraph system gets going if there's a household without a servant. And I literally mean this, you have an endless stream of both men and women coming to your front door asking for work. Any work, can we trim the garden, can we paint your roof, but will you take us on into the household? When I'm talking about unemployment, it really is rife. And because so many categories of jobs are closed to black people, and because the training for blacks is of the nature that it is, domestic service is one of the sort of easier avenues in which to gain employment. So one has to rationalize, well, you know, I'm employing someone who otherwise wouldn't be employed. I will try to make the relationship the best possible one that we can have within the circumstances. And I really do hope that the woman who worked for me, with whom I remain in constant letter contact at the moment, that we did work out a relationship. It was certainly satisfactory from my point, and I do hope that she says she does, so I do hope she means when she says what she says, that it was a good relationship for her too.
Mm-hmm.
And she was wonderful with my children. All the time that I was running around waving banners and giving speeches, both she and my mother-in-law and my mother were there to look after the children. And I meet many professional women now in the United States who are faced with very much the same question. If they want to pursue an active career, who are they going to have to look after their children?
I'll tell you something I've never understood about the white master black servant relationship in South Africa, since so many of the whites in South Africa really fear blacks and think that they are racially inferior to whites, why do they feel so comfortable then having black people bring up their children? It seems like such a contradiction.
I think it is a contradiction. I think South Africa is a land of contradictions. I don't think many whites, and I say this advisedly, as I have done in many different occasions, that whites don't necessarily see blacks as people. They're seen, you know, people in the sense of themselves, they're individuals. They're seen either as my domestic servant, my gardener, the person who brings the tea around in the office, and so on. And it's just easier to say, well, I know so-and-so knows me and I know so-and-so, and he's a good black or she's a good servant, and just to rationalize it that way so that element of fear is removed. It's no longer a black face or someone potentially part of a threatening black mass. It's simply Maria who works in the kitchen, and, you know, she's there as part of the... I don't want to say the word furniture, but I've actually heard people say that to me. Maria belongs in this house just as this and that and the other does.
Was it difficult for you as a mother to know that your children were learning history from white South African textbooks?
Yes, and I really did my best to subvert that whenever I could, obviously. I mean, I learned it myself and didn't. I had one teacher who was very good at pointing out the iniquities of what we were learning. But sure, it was difficult, and it's not only the textbooks; it's the invidious type of indoctrination.
What's an example of the kind of indoctrination you felt you were exposed to?
You mean when I was at school?
Yeah,
yeah. Well, it was in a history course. One thought that the world in South Africa began in 1652 when the Dutch settlers arrived from Europe. If one delved any deeper, you know, it was severely discouraged and almost one could be excommunicated. So there was that sort of approach. The whole bias was written from the point of view of the Afrikaners, whether it was through any of the wars, through any of the great discoveries, through any of the industrial enterprises. It was always from an Afrikaner bias, and then very much from a Christian and national bias as well. Which is part of the indoctrination, you know, the three legs of the Afrikaner indoctrination technique.
You explained to us a little earlier that although you always opposed apartheid, you didn't want to spend your life in prison and that you didn't plan on becoming a radical. As a liberal, I'm sure the government still saw you as a threat. Were there any reprisals against you?
Yeah, from when I embarked public life, when I took office, and even years before that, I mean, I'm talking now from about the beginning of the 70s, it was almost an everyday occurrence to have some sort of phone call, either a threatening phone call or a so-called dirty phone call related to the work that I was doing. I did receive numerous letters threatening my life and threatening my children's lives. And there was the type of things that happened to friends of mine and colleagues who worked alongside me. Tires slashed at night, bullet holes in windows, a more extreme manifestation being pets found skinned on doorsteps. So that sort of thing was just part of the daily life of being a white liberal.
Did that have anything to do with your decision to leave?
Not that per se. Shortly we had already started making up our minds to leave South Africa, and shortly after I had been very active in a campaign against the new constitution in 1984 and had been part of the founding movement of the UDF, the United Democratic Front, I was visited by the security police who wanted to ask me certain questions about my car, whether my car had been stolen. When I said no, it hadn't, they said, well, this car has been seen at these various addresses. And so I said, yes, well, I was there with my car at those addresses. You know, anything wrong with that? And they said, no, but there may be someday. And I got the message. I also know that my phone was tapped for years and years and years and years. So that sort of surveillance is really wearying. One gets worn down by it. And I always remember the feeling of relief and freedom when I came out of South Africa, when we went overseas to Europe or England or the States, you can almost hit your head on a tree because you can just feel the difference in the air. And I just think that I'd reached a point where I really deep down believed I'd done all I could. I was not prepared to be violent, to take revolutionary action. And I just felt that I could do more out of the country, exposing apartheid in the way I knew it and bearing witness to it, than I could in the country.
Now that you're living in Boston, are you still trying to do work to oppose apartheid in your home country?
Yeah, I'm constantly in touch with people in the grassroots, particularly in the labor movement, which, because of my work on the Johannesburg City Council, became a real interest of mine. I do a lot of writing for various intelligence reports on South Africa, on labor relations. And the speaking that I do is about South Africa and the way I saw South Africa. You know, hopefully this book will show people, fill a gap that I think I don't think there has been a book covering the sort of story that that I give. And I think that the response so far is that, in fact, I have achieved that people do feel that I've filled in areas of knowledge that they didn't, were not in touch with before.